Going Linux, episode 131, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that'll help you in going Linux.
In today's episode, listener feedback. We hope that you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
And we've got a little bit different setup this time as far as recording is concerned, because Skype Call Recorder, which is a wonderful application, does not work perfectly in the new Ubuntu for some reason.
Right. We found out in our last recording session that instead of actually separating the two channels, your voice and my voice, as it's done in previous installations on older versions of Ubuntu on your machine, it was actually merging the two together. So we had not even stereo. It was recording stereo channels, but each channel had both voices on it, which was completely useless.
Editing nightmare.
Yeah. So what we're doing this time is going back to the back-to-back recording where I record my end on Audacity. Tom, you're recording your end on Audacity. And we're testing out Skype and Skype Call Recorder running on Linux Mint in a virtual machine, a VirtualBox virtual machine, on my computer. So we'll see how that works.
Let's explain, Skype Call Recorder does work in Mint, just yeah, the way it always did.
And I'm running it on Mint 10, which is...
is running inside Ubuntu.
Yeah, well, they make the case that perhaps they're not using straight Ubuntu anymore. Certainly, they have the Debian edition, but they also have their classic edition, if you will, that is based on the Ubuntu code, I guess, but isn't just straight Ubuntu as it was when they first rolled out Mint. They actually do some different things to it now. So whatever they're doing to it, it makes Skype and Skype Call Recorder work where it doesn't on Ubuntu 10.10. Yeah. At least it doesn't work perfectly. It works. It records.
Actually, I'm on 10.04.
You're on 10.04, and I'm on 10.10, and it does the same thing on both.
Yeah.
So, thank you, Ubuntu.
Well, it's not Ubuntu's fault.
Well, it's somebody's fault. And,
it was... Skype Call Recorder was written for an earlier version, I think, so...
Yeah. But, Mint 10 is... ostensibly the same kernel and the same, it's the same stuff. So yeah. What's going on? There's something with the audio.
I don't know. Well, a couple of days ago, I texted you because I had a horrible problem. I had installed Moblin. Here's what happened. I was talking to Bill, and Bill said that the next versions of Ubuntu should not be running, what is it? It's not Epiphany, it's...
Unity.
That they should be running Moblin instead, because Moblin looks really cool. So I said, oh, well, I'll go see what Moblin is all about. So I installed that, and I rebooted, and I said, I want the Moblin desktop. It's called the Moblin User Experience, which was horribly crippled, and I was dead once again. Because of my continuous tinkering. So, of course, my next thought was, okay, I'll stick in a live CD and get the... oh, wait a minute. I'm on a netbook. It doesn't have a CD drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a bootable pen drive. Well, you told me, try just deleting Moblin and see if it goes back to GNOME. And it did.
Yeah.
But that scared me a little bit because I still didn't have a bootable anything for this machine. And then I thought about it a little. And my Sansa Fuse media player has a little micro SD slot in it that's got a micro SD card in it. You know, it's about half the size of your little finger, 2 gigabyte deal.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll see if I can make that bootable. And I tried, is it called Unet Bootin' or something like that?
Yes, that's it. Unet
Yeah,
Bootin'.
that. And by golly, if my MP3 player is plugged in, I can boot off of that. How cool is that?
That is cool. So your MP3 player is your rescue disc.
It's exactly right. Exactly right.
That
That's
is
the
cool.
flotation device that I can grab onto if I do something really stupid and the ship goes down.
Oh man. Well, that's our hardware pick for
Yeah.
the
Yeah.
day. Oh man. Well, between the two of us, we're having all kinds of experimental things going on. Well, and getting back to the Skype thing, the reason that I want to test out this Skype call recorder on my end and getting it working is not for our regular episodes of the podcast, because that we can handle ourselves, because each of us has, the ability to go
Sure.
ahead and record our ends of the conversation. But I am going to be doing an interview, and by the time this episode comes out, you will already have heard the interview with Nick Bolton of Synergy. You remember Synergy,
All
the
right.
program that allows you to share your mouse and your keyboard between computers?
Right.
Yeah. So I will be interviewing him on Monday, and he's located in London, England. And I wanted to make sure that I had everything ready for recording, and I have no idea how the interview went, although, because we haven't had the interview yet. And
Right.
as you can tell, we record these things a little bit ahead of time. And by the time you'll be hearing this listener feedback episode, the interview will be done. You'll all know that it went perfectly. Let's hope.
Right.
And the other reason that I was messing around with this is because I will be talking at the Southern California Linux Expo that is coming up February 25th through the 27th and is in the Hilton, Los Angeles Airport.
Right.
And my talk will be on producing a podcast using Linux. And so I wanted to make sure that I had all of the inside scoop on Skype call recorder, since that's the thing that you usually use. I wanted to be able to talk intelligently about Skype call recorder and all of its ins and outs, so that if I get a question on it, I can answer them.
Sure. So what are we doing today? We're doing listener feedback again.
We're doing listener feed. We have lots of listener feedback, and I haven't gotten through it all yet. I still have lots. I'm thinking of my 2 hours with Computer America will be a full 2 hours of email. No, I'm not going to do that. But that would be one way to get through it all.
Sure.
Well,
This is going to turn into a listener feedback program.
yeah, I think so. All I can say is thank you for all of the feedback, and I'm glad we decided early on to have a full episode dedicated to listener feedback.
Well, speaking of listener feedback, since we have so much, let's get into it.
And before we get into our regularly scheduled programming, first a word from our
Yeah,
sponsors.
right.
Today's episode of Going Linux is brought to you by Audible.com.
Dot com. Yes, it is. And right now, to receive your audiobooks, you'll need to use Audible's proprietary player in Windows in a virtual machine, or Wine, since they don't yet have a player that runs natively under Linux. Boop, boop, boop. If you have one of those options available to you, then we have a special URL that lets you sign up for a free audiobook and a 14-day free trial.
If you can't or won't run Windows or the proprietary audio player, we'd like you to sign up for your free trial, then contact Audible at audible.custhelp.com. That's audible.custhelp.com, to let them know that you want a Linux player so that you can listen to their content. If you're an open source software developer, we'd love it if you would contact Audible at greatideas@audible.com and help them in their efforts to develop a player for Linux.
The place to go to get your special offer from Audible is audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. Get a free audiobook and a 14-day trial today by signing up at www.audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. And of course, that is spelled audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux.
Okay, and now our first email is a voicemail. Does that make sense? Our first listener feedback is a voicemail from Richard from Toronto. He says, "Hi, Larry and Bob."
Bob.
Oh, Bob. Okay. Really? Maybe with all this talk about audio quality, it's not so good. I don't know, Tom. Richard, it's Tom.
Well, Bob was my stage name in Atlantic City.
All right. We'll give him that. Okay. Let's listen to Richard's voicemail here.
Hi, Larry and Bob. This is Richard from Toronto. My story is I've been a Linux user off and on since about 2005 with different distros, but not very seriously. I've always thought that any serious work that I wanted to do, I'd have to use Windows. And so I've been dabbling all this time with distros here and there, but treated them mostly as toys until I heard your podcast. And now I'm starting to take it a little more seriously. I have Linux Mint 10 on one of my machines. And I really like it, and I'm taking it a little bit more seriously. I'm trying to wean myself off of Windows, and my approach is task-oriented. So one of my first tasks is to, since I have a network set up in my house with different machines, I have to share files off of a network-attached storage, which uses anonymous FTP. Well, I thought I would start off by looking for an FTP client like GFTP, because I remember using it years ago, and it would work if I logged in as root or started GFTP as root. It would let me transfer files to and from my file server onto the desktop, and no problems at all, except when I logged back in as a normal user, it wouldn't allow me access anymore because of permissions. So GFTP turned out to be permission hell. Yes, I could go in, I could right-click and change all the permissions of the files every time I wanted to use them, log in as a super user, and start as super user, transfer the files, then log in as a normal user, or change the permissions before that. Absolutely horrendous. I would never want to work that way. So my next step was to look for Conqueror, and I didn't realize at the time that Conqueror was for the K desktop, not the G desktop. And so I downloaded about 90 some odd files, and I got Conqueror working, and it wasn't very satisfactory either. It didn't work. And so I thought of FileZilla. I've used it on Windows a lot. Then I realized Nautilus is part of the G desktop, so it should be there. And I went looking for it. Do you think I could find it on any of the menus? And then it hit me. Okay, Nautilus is the Windows equivalent to File Explorer on Windows. And so all I had to do was click on a file folder, and there was Nautilus. And I could configure it very easily to log in to an FTP file server and transfer files. Once you get used to it, it's actually pretty good. The only problem is it won't go more than one layer of subdirectories deep. So actually, I don't mind that because I can go into subdirectories and recreate them when I transfer. But maybe there's a solution to that as well. My setup is my main computer has multiple hard drives that I can slide in. SATA drives that slide in on a front drawer, and I've got two internal hard drives inside, so three altogether. So I can't understand why people would want to dual boot any computer. this setup, I can slide in a hard drive, and I have a toggle switch on the front panel which kills the power to the two internal hard drives. And when I boot it up, the system doesn't recognize the internal hard drives. I can go ahead and install any operating system I want, different flavors of Linux on different hard drives, and it works really well. I made the mistake one time before of not having that toggle switch, and I installed a Linux on one of my storage drives inside, which was a real mistake, and that's why I put the toggle switch on the front. I have, of course, DSL modem, wireless router switch, and about three computers all at my desk here on a small little network. And with a KVM switch, I can just press a button and go to any computer I want. I have I've taken Windows 7 off of one of my mini computers here, and that's what the one I put Mint on. Love it. I think it's great. And love your podcast. Thank you very much for doing it. I hope you continue. In case you want to mention my website, it's rustymicrophone.com. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, thanks, Richard, for that voicemail.
And as far as I'm concerned, you know, you talked about not considering Linux as a toy. It really is a pretty good toy.
Yeah, that's for sure. Okay, and Richard followed up later with an email. He says, "Hi, Larry and Bob." Hi, Richard. I recently sent you an audio comment where I was using Mint 10 in a more serious way. My goal is to do my 23rd podcast completely on Linux. I have 14 podcasts on, that must be podcast episodes, on rustymicrophone.com. And I'm now doing my 9th podcast episode on rickyradio.com. I have my Mint version 10 working very well with my NAS file server. That's network attached storage, for those of you not familiar with that acronym. Up until now, I have done all my podcast post-production work on Audacity, but on Windows. So, on the Linux machine, my next goal is to import my raw recorded WAV file into Audacity. That worked okay. I also installed LAME. Audacity runs quite well under Mint, but it looks very different from the Windows version. Then I ran into a serious problem. I couldn't run Levelator on Linux. Levelator used to work on older versions of Linux, but I didn't want to get into all the complexities of trying to make it work on Mint 10. For those who don't know, Levelator is a compressor for fixing up your audio. I consider proper compression to be absolutely essential for this kind of work. Levelator has always been considered the best for the job. So, here's what I found. The compressor that is built into Audacity has a bad reputation. It really sucks. But Chris's dynamic compressor plugin is said to be even better than Levelator. The URL for that is, and we'll, it's pretty long, so we'll include it in the show notes. I had a lot of trouble installing the plugin, but finally figured out that you have to copy the compress.ny file into this folder, and it's the /share/audacity/plugins folder. At least on Mint it is. On this plugin, the normal default numbers are 0.5, 0.5, minus 32, 0, and 0.99. I changed these numbers to 0.85, 0.5, minus 32, 2, and 0.95, and you will find this compressor works even better than Levelator. I was really surprised. I don't know what all those numbers are, but I'm reading it. So
sure.
I'm sure they mean something once you look at the plugin. My next podcast will be up soon. So far, it looks like I will be able to do it all in Linux this time. My next task is to find a Linux solution to the problem of placing album art and MP3 tag information into this file. I'll let you know what I find. Your podcast is excellent. Keep up the good work. Richard.
Well, okay. Thanks, Richard.
Yeah, and thanks for the information on the plugin. I tried the Chris's Dynamic Compressor plugin, and it seems to work just fine. Richard actually wrote back again later saying that after some testing, he's not so sure that Chris's dynamic compressor is so good. I did also, quite early on in our podcast history, Tom, I tried the Levelator. And it works under Linux if you put it under Wine. And
There is a Linux version now.
Oh, okay. At the time, there wasn't.
Yeah, but it's in a, you have to compile it, I think. It's in a tired GZ, one of those deals.
Got it.
But I think that maybe running the Windows version under Wine would work pretty well in Mint.
Yeah, and it did. It worked okay for me under whatever I was using at the time. It was probably an early version of Ubuntu. But one of the things I found was it involved some extra conversion of the file. So I had to save it, I think, as a WAV file.
Right, yeah, that's right.
I had to drag and drop it onto the levelator, and then the levelator chew on it for a bit, and then I had to take it back and reconvert it. So I wasn't too pleased. Although the sound was fine, I wasn't too pleased with it. And for those of you listening to the podcast, I just use the standard compressor feature in Audacity for Linux. Yeah, and there's also a leveler feature, which I've tried out, and it appears
doesn't
to be something.
Right.
No, it doesn't seem to work quite as well as just using the standard compressor. I tried Chris's dynamic compressor plugin and didn't find too much difference between the standard compressor and the settings that I'm using and what it was doing. So I'm sticking with the way we've been doing it all along. And it seems to work just fine for us. I haven't heard anybody talk about really bad audio quality since some of the first episodes that Serge and I did way back when.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Richard also asked a question or implied a question about finding something for MP3 tags and for album art. And the thing that I use, and it works just fine with the iTunes MP3 version of the feed and the files, and with the AUG version of the files as well, and that is EasyTag. And I've heard that there are some easier ways of tagging than EasyTag, despite what the name implies. But I like it because although I use the metadata editor in Audacity to put in the tags initially, when I convert the MP3 and the AUG from Audacity, the tags appear differently in both file, in each of the files. So what I do is I actually open up EasyTag and I highlight both the MP3 and the AUG version of the file. And depending on which one you click first, you can get the tags from the MP3 or the AUG to show up. And I forget which one has the better set of tags, but it allows you to click on a little dot next to the title, the artist, the album, and it'll apply whatever's on your screen to both of the files that you have selected. So it makes tagging them very easy because you can do it simultaneously and just with a click of a button if you use the metadata editor in Audacity. And then you can add the album art under the Pictures tab in EasyTag, and it works quite well. And I've tested the tags and the album art under iTunes, under an iPod and an iPhone, and the MP3 version works just fine there. And under GPodder, and when I was using Rhythmbox, both the MP3 and the AUG versions appear just fine with the album art and the tags perfectly. So I'm quite happy with EasyTag. So you might want to try that out, Richard.
Okay.
And our next voicemail is from Nick. And Nick actually sent us a couple of voicemails, and I think I've got them edited down. Unfortunately, I don't think he was able to finish his thought before hanging up or before being cut off. I'm not exactly sure. We're going to have to check out that voicemail line, make sure it's working properly. But let's at least listen to what Nick attempted to say on his voicemail.
Hi, guys. And I guess now you're going to say, hi, Nick. So here's my 2 cents on going Linux. I am an avid Linux user and most recently an avid Going Linux podcast listener. I'm currently a student in high school, and I take classes on computer science. And so during the lectures that are pre-recorded for us, as an avid enthusiast of technology, I pretty much turn down the volume on the lectures and go into Going Linux and listen to your podcast. And I have got to tell you that from beginning users to like advanced users, you guys have just done a terrific job at explaining everything. I have recommended you to multiple friends. You're putting the information out there to where my father could understand it, my mother, who is almost technologically illiterate, could understand it, my little brother understands it. I just wanted to drop you guys a line and say, great job.
And for those people who are using the call-in, the phone version of voicemail, remember to speak up, because if you start getting quiet, it won't detect you anymore and it'll hang up on you. So sound off.
Maybe that's what happened to Nick then.
I think so.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
Nick followed up with an email with a Gone Linux story. He says, hi, guys. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Nick.
My name is Nick. I'm the owner of armygeeks.com and a current avid Linux user. But it's been a long journey for me, as it has been for anyone who switched from Windows. It started about 5 years ago when I was 14 years old. My friend, who is a research technician at a university, was using Ubuntu 7.04 and was showing me videos of CompiS on his desktop. At the time, being 14, all I could think was, wow! So I downloaded the ISO and burned it to a disk and installed it on the family computer. Big mistake. My whole family was unhappy, so I quickly installed Windows back onto the machine and all was well again. So then I decided to install Ubuntu on my old eMachine PC, Intel Celeron processor at 500 megahertz and 128 megabyte of RAM.
Ooh.
Yeah. It ran, not amazing, but it ran. I continued to show an interest in Linux and computers in general. So that year for Christmas, my parents got me a new Dell PC, but told me not to install Linux on it because it was under warranty and they did not want to void said warranty. So I surfed the web on my Dell and did my playing on the old eMachines, going through the different distributions, but eventually settling on Puppy. That's probably a good choice for a old slow machine.
Yeah. Yep.
The big upgrade came when I ordered a new Celeron processor at 766 megahertz and upgraded the RAM to 512 megs. Woo! That was a huge upgrade. And coupled with the high-speed DSL my parents had just ordered, the old eMachines was a speed demon that matched the likes of my Pentium 4 Dell with Windows. My father, who was a computer science major in the early 80s, was highly impressed to see what I did with the old computer. So, my Dell lasted another 2 years on warranty, and after the said 2 years, I cracked open the case and upgraded. Forgive me if my years are not correct, because I'm estimating. I actually stayed on that Dell without the need to upgrade anything except RAM and the hard drive because of the efficiency that Linux has. In fact, I still use the same Dell computer now, with 2 gigabyte DDR RAM and 80 gigabyte hard drive and NVIDIA 6200. I really need a new one, but that will come soon. Along the way, I inspired my local high school to drop Microsoft Office and switch to OpenOffice.
Yeah, good job.
Yeah. And some of the computers in the main computer lab run the most current Ubuntu release and are frequently updated. Thanks for reading, and feel free to drop me a line. Nick? And he signs it, editor of Army Geeks.
Yeah. Oh, good job, Nick. Thanks for sharing. That's good stuff.
Very good.
Okay, moving on to our next email. Mike wrote to us and said, hi, Larry / Tom. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
/ Mike. Got a question for you. Never thought to ask. By and large, I'm doing great with Linux. I wish I could use it more at work. Anywho, I have a Lexmark Prevail Pro 705 printer scanner and can't get a 64-bit Linux driver for it. I don't print much anyway, so my short-term solution was just to make a 32-bit Ubuntu virtual machine and power it up, plug in the printer when I wanted to print or scan something. What's annoying is whenever I plug in the USB cable, the 64-bit Ubuntu always detects a new device and tries to locate the driver before I can have a chance to connect it to the virtual machine. Now, granted, it's a piffing annoyance, not a huge problem by any stretch of the imagination, but I figure it can't hurt to ask. Is there a way to keep Ubuntu 10.04 from searching for drivers it doesn't have when a specific USB device connects that it doesn't recognize? Peace. Tom, any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do have an idea. I think that you can go into Nautilus, and I'm in Nautilus right now, so I'll check this out as we speak. Nautilus, edit preferences, because I think Nautilus is what's picking up on the media that's been plugged in. Okay, now there's file management preferences, and I've got media, and I think you can select, yeah, you can tell it when this sort of a thing gets plugged in, do nothing. Don't do anything at all.
Yes, set the default, right.
There's different categories. You got CD audio, DVD audio, music player, photos, software, and then other media, blank Blu-ray, blank CD. So he might be able to find something in there and tell it, do nothing.
Right. Well, and I wasn't sure when I responded back to him, but what I did do is I went on the Lexmark site, and apparently they have a 64-bit driver for that printer now for Linux. And so I sent him the link, and we'll include the link in the show notes. And hopefully that 64-bit printer driver works, and everything now is okay for Mike. Thanks for your email, Mike.
And we'll put that link in the show notes, right?
Of course we will.
Okay. Okay, so next up we've got Paul, who wrote in about Boxy. Paul said, hi, Larry and Tom.
Hi,
Paul.
Hi, Paul.
I've listened to your latest episode and have heard you mention the Boxy software. I feel excited at the process of trying this software on my OpenSUSE 11.3 machine that I have set up here at home. Unfortunately, I've been unable to do so because they do not offer me an RPM package. How disappointing. I've attempted to download the source file and install the application. Unfortunately, I'm having difficulties. I've posted a message in the OpenSUSE forums, and I've just finished typing in my issue in the Boxy forums. I can see that this may be a frustrating issue in relation to someone who's a newbie to Linux. Just thought I'd share my frustrations. Sorry for ranting. I hope that the exposure on your show may convince the developers to port an RPM for this. Thank you for the show.
Well, perhaps you're giving our show a little too much credit.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure we have that much influence. However, you're absolutely right, Paul, that these companies would do much better, I think, if they were to provide at least a deb file and an RPM package for Linux users compiling from source code. It's very uncomfortable at best, and at worst, very scary. Compiling in the grand scheme of things isn't all that difficult, but it does require quite a few more steps than clicking and installing. Looking at the website, it appears that the Linux version of Boxy software is specifically designed to run on Ubuntu. The system requirements make no mention of any Red Hat-based version. There are ways to convert a deb file to an RPM package using the Alien command line application, for example, but if you're getting the errors you mentioned with the source code installation, then there's literally no hope that this is going to work for you. Your best bet is to complain, as you did, to the Boxy folks and to ask for help on the SUSE forums, as you also did. Someone at SUSE, brighter than you and me combined, might be able to come up with a solution, but I don't hold out a lot of hope.
Yeah.
Good luck, Paul.
You might want to
move
come
over
on
to
over
Ubuntu.
to the Ubuntu. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you might do that. Yeah, I liked OpenSUSE a lot. And one of the reasons I switched over to Ubuntu is it is more popular, and as a result, more software vendors make their software that will run on Ubuntu and not so much on RPM-based distributions like SUSE. But, I did like OpenSUSE. Just
and
saying.
Just as an aside, by the time this airs, IBM supercomputer Watson will have appeared on the Jeopardy program.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you overseas, Jeopardy is a game show that tests your knowledge about everything. And Watson is going to be a competitor, and I'm pretty sure that Watson runs SUSE Enterprise, isn't it?
I don't know, but I would suspect that Watson probably has a slight advantage being plugged directly into Wikipedia. Just a little advantage there.
Yeah.
So, okay.
I don't know if it is capable of searching the web, or if it's just got lots and lots of facts stored away.
It could be. Yeah, they could just copy Wikipedia and put it into Watson's brain, you know.
Sure.
Come on.
Although Wikipedia isn't always right. So.
Well, and that's the risk you run.
There you go.
All right. Our next email is from Ryan, who also wrote about Boxy. He said, "Hi, Larry and Tom."
Hi, Ryan. Hi, Ryan.
Just a few comments on episode 128. First, Boxy doesn't yet support Netflix on Linux. And I know I had said that it did. They're working on getting it working for the Boxy Box, which I own and love. It uses and by the way, the Boxy Box is the hardware version of Boxy that they sell with the Boxy software already pre-installed.
Right, it's an appliance.
Yes. It uses a slightly different version of the software than the vanilla Linux Boxy package, so I don't know if Netflix is coming to the Linux desktop yet. The Roku does support Netflix and runs Linux as well. The info about Boxy has been a bit muddled recently. They are trying very hard to get Netflix on the Boxy box. They already have it for Windows. I'm not sure about Mac. The website has a giant Netflix logo that is a bit misleading. And yes, that's in fact what misled me when I mentioned that to you, is that huge Netflix logo.
Mm-hmm.
Their marketing and PR hasn't being the best in the last few months. I still love it, and I'm happy that they are adding new features on a frequent basis. I am an officer in the U.S. Air Force. I'm specifically a physicist primarily working in the space domain. I try to get open source used wherever I can, though it's a struggle sometimes. I'm currently getting my master's degree in operations research at AFIT, A-F-I-T, one of those military acronyms, I'm sure. And I do all my research and simulations on Ubuntu using Python. I have even got a few classmates to try and eventually convert to Python and Linux. Thanks for all the hard work you and Tom put into the show, Ryan. Well, thanks, Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah.
And I'm on Wikipedia right now, and AFIT is the Air Force Institute of Technology.
All right.
A graduate school and provider of professional and continuing education that's part of the United States Air Force. Okay, well, now we know what AFIT is.
Perfect.
So next we've got JD, who also commented. He said, hi, Larry and Tom. Hi, JD.
Hi, JD.
The WDTV Live HD Plus runs on Linux and supports Netflix. And JD gives us a link. And he says, but it has a specific chip to make that happen. The entire file system may also be encrypted to enable Netflix support. I don't know the details of other Linux-based Netflix support devices, like the Roku, but I suspect that it is hardware and or encryption involved that meets the contractual requirements of the content providers. Like you, I don't know of any way to view Netflix on a general-purpose computer running Linux. This type of issue is rarely as simple as it seems to us on the outside. And he signs it JD in Marietta. Okay, Larry, what is the WDTV Live HD Plus?
Okay, going to the link that JD provided us, it says that the WDTV is a consumer device produced by Western Digital, that's the WD part of it, that allows users to watch videos as well as view images and listen to music from USB devices, or USB drives, it says. It is capable of playing high-definition video through an HDMI port and in addition to supporting video through composite cables. It can play most common video and audio formats. And scrolling down the article to where you get to the WDTV Live Plus, it says, released early in 2010 and having the features of WDTV Live, along with Netflix streaming support. In order to support Netflix, the Linux system is now encrypted. And it gives all kinds of specs about this thing. And I have no idea how this thing works or how well it works.
But it seems to be some kind of an appliance again.
Yes, exactly. And we can only trust that JD has tried it out and hopefully it works well.
Sure.
So if you want Netflix on Linux, that might be the way to do it.
And I see what he's talking about. Netflix doesn't want you streaming their video and then saving it.
Yeah.
To a CD or something, so they're encrypting it, and this box preserves the encryption. So, okay, I get it.
Yeah. So it looks like you can't run some software on your Linux computer and get Netflix streaming. Not yet, anyway.
Yet. Yeah, not yet.
Yeah. Okay, our next email is from Thomas, who wrote with a question about video. Ha! And lots of video this time.
Yeah.
Hi, Larry and Tom.
Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Thomas. Love the podcast. I've dabbled with various Linux flavors. My favorite is Ubuntu and Mint. I work on computers as a hobby and have converted some of my users. I'm not a purist. I just believe in the right tool for the job. If Linux fits, I use it, and that applies to most users. If Windows fits, I use it. For example, for games. If Mac fits, I use it. I own systems as far back as Windows 98 for various users and as new as Windows 7. But this is not why I'm writing in. I'm using a P4 1GB RAM Windows XP for a surveillance cam set up for my house. It allows motion detection pictographs. My big problem is it only allows one camera. I want more than one. All my cameras work under Ubuntu and Mint. I want to use this system to monitor my yard and vehicles, but can't find a Linux alternative. And I also want to use this system as a file server, since it will never go to sleep or be turned off. I would also, if possible, like to see the pics or a live feed away from my home. Let me know if it's possible. My system is a P4 3.0, 1GB RAM, software Windows XP SP3, Dorgan. Don't know what Dorgan is.
Yeah, got me there.
Maybe that's the login name. And we can't help you with Windows problems. So moving on. P.S. I started over to hear all of your episodes when I was listening to episode 111, and I'm trying to catch up. If I want to fix Windows PCs, I have a live CD handy, and I use more Linux to fix Windows than the other way around. Thanks, Thomas. Well, Thomas, I'm assuming that although you have Windows XP on that machine, that you want to move it over to Linux. And in that case, maybe we can help you out. And I wrote back, as you did, Tom, to Thomas, and my comments were, my experience with cameras is limited to vacation snapshots and videos. A quick Google search for multiple cameras Linux yielded a series of forum posts that seemed pretty informative, and I'll include a link in our show notes to those forum posts. And the guys in this forum post discuss some software and camera options as well as some cautions to be aware of. And there's also a discussion on the Ubuntu forum that discusses some additional issues. We'll have a link to that too. They mentioned two software programs, Motion, which Tom, I know you mentioned, and ZoneMinder. Both are available in the Ubuntu repositories. And Tom, why don't you go ahead and read what you wrote back to Thomas?
Well, I wrote, I don't know about ZoneMinder, but Motion works quite well for video, stills, and multiple cameras. Because it uses USB ports, you don't have to worry about converting video to digital or the like. Just plug in the cameras. And it sounds like you're going to have some long reaches, so you're going to want amplified USB cables. Just Google that and you'll see what it is. It's a USB cable with an amplifier and a wall wart to power it. There's no real need to set up a server, I don't think. Motion will store the videos or the images wherever you like, and you can store them in your Dropbox folder, and then they're accessible from anywhere. And to get Motion from Ubuntu, just type sudo apt-get install Motion. And let me know when you run into a hitch, and I'll talk you through it. And our last email for this episode comes from Heather. And Heather says, hello. Hello, Heather.
Hi, Heather.
First of all, I want to say thank you for these wonderful podcasts. I bought a used laptop recently with the desire to start running Linux instead of Windows. I was very hesitant to start and a little scared, but after a few of your podcasts, I took the plunge and loaded Ubuntu 10.10 on my machine. So far, it's a wonderful experience, and I hope to become very proficient with it, as I do love to tinker. I just have a few questions for you. I've listened to the first 5 episodes of the podcast, and since I am starting a bit late to the game, I was wondering if there were a few that you could recommend that I listen to right away so that I can jump in. Also, I was wondering if there were any books on the subject that you would recommend. And my last question is, are there any resources for kids on the subject of Linux? I would love to get my kids involved as young as possible. Thank you again, and I'll be listening. Heather. Wow.
Great email. Yeah, lots of questions. Yeah, very good. Very good questions. And I wrote back to Heather, and let me read my response. I'm happy to read that you are a listener to the podcast and that you're enjoying Ubuntu. You will find many resources, including electronic books, listed at our resources page. And you get there by typing into your browser resources.goinglinux.com. You'll also find a listing of the show notes for episode 126, where I discuss where to find, quote, the manual for various Linux distributions, including Ubuntu. And we'll include a link both to the resources page link and to the show notes for episode 126 in our show notes for this episode. As for the resources for kids learning Linux, just let them get on the system and play. Depending on the age of your children, they might enjoy many of the free games that are available in the Ubuntu Software Center. Also, here is a link to an article that discusses some kid-friendly Linux distributions and software applications that run on almost any version of Linux. And we'll have a link to that in our show notes as well. It's an article from Lifehacker.
Okay.
Remember to look in the Ubuntu Software Center first for these applications. They may already be there. It's really tough to recommend just a few episodes of our podcast for you to go back and listen to. You can find a full list of topics we cover at the bottom of our show notes page, but here are a few of my favorites that might get you started. Episode 9, Adjusting to Linux, the Introduction. Episode 17, Word Processors and Text Editors, an Introduction. Episode 29, Backups, an Introduction. Episode 65, Linux Desktops, an Introduction. Episode 76, Linux File Systems, an Introduction. And episode 94, my talk at Southern California Linux Expo 8X, that's last year's talk, on Linux for Windows users. And that was all about switching from Windows and making the adjustment. So all of those, I think, would be a good place to start. And thanks for listening.
And we'll put all of those suggestions in the show notes, all those links.
You betcha.
Okay, and we've got a Gone Linux now, huh?
Yeah, a final one here from Bill.
Okay.
Why don't you take this one, Tom?
Got it. Bill wrote, hi, Tom and Larry. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
I recently received a Crash Dell Mini 1010 from my sister, where Windows showed the dreaded blue screen of death. She was fed up and just gave me the netbook. 60 minutes later, I had Ubuntu 10.04 installed off a flash drive with UNetbootin. The wireless setup was a challenge, but after scouring the forums for BCM43, that's Broadcom Wireless, I discovered a great link for folks using Ubuntu on a mini, and that's www.ubuntumini.com. Bill, well, thanks for that, Bill. We love to hear about the successes.
Yes, you bet we do. And I thought Ubuntu Mini was for running Ubuntu on, you know, one of those Mini Coopers. But maybe not. All right. Well, thanks, Bill. That's a great Gunlytics story and very typical of what happens with crashed computers.
Yeah.
Blue screen.
No more blue screen
death.
And death.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, Tom, just when I was traveling this past week, I was flying through Dallas, and I got up to the gate in Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and they have these video monitors above the gate that show you the gate number and when the flight's going to depart and so on, and I walked up, and here the monitor is glowing blue. It's a blue screen of death.
Beautiful.
And it's just sitting there, and they have a paper with the flight number and the departure time taped to the monitor over the blue screen of death.
Gorgeous. Just
yes,
beautiful.
And they have the back of the panel open, and you can see that it's a flat screen monitor, and it's got one of the Dell workstations sitting in there, and they're trying frantically to get this thing booted, and you can see on the screen that they're trying to boot it from the network, so it appears that it's a network boot. It's a dumb terminal, basically, connected to a Windows server somewhere, and mm-hmm. I guess, you know, all the other monitors in the terminal were working just fine, but this particular one, maybe there was something wrong on that machine, and I was so tempted to take a picture, but that's been done so many times.
Yeah, but they had their backup system working perfectly, and that was made out of dead trees.
Yes, that's right, and a
beautiful
Sharpie marker, and it worked just fine. So I picked up my Android phone, went on the internet, and figured out, you know, when it was going to depart, and kept up to
sure.
date on all that. So anyway, blue screen of death appears everywhere. Yep.
All right, well, I think that wraps it up, Larry. I don't see any more on the screen here.
Nope, and that's not because we had a crash. It's because there's no more on the screen.
Okay.
All right, do either of us have a software pick this time around?
I'm liking UNet Bootin. However, I wish it made persistent bootable system. But for emergency use, this is just fine.
Well, you know, we didn't include it this time, but we did get an email from someone mentioning something called Multiboot that apparently does create not only persistent images, but if you have a large enough thumb drive, you can actually put multiple persistent images on the drive. I went to the website, and it's in French. I used the Google Translator to translate it, and it's in broken English.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure I can quite follow everything, but we'll investigate it a little bit further. And you might want to just Google for Multiboot. I don't remember the URL, but it's a website out of France and might just help us out. So
sure.
Let's give it a try. Yeah.
We'll include that email from the listener in our next listener feedback episode.
Okay. And for software pick for me, I don't know. Let's just say I don't have one.
Works for me.
Yes. Our next episode is Computer America number 36. Until that episode, you can go and look at our past episodes, look at the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com. And for more information, detailed instructions, screencast, and illustrations, go to the same place, goinglinux.com. You can also send us an audio comment by email. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com, and our voicemail is 1-904-468-7889. And for those of us with North America keyboards on our phones, it is 1-904-4-OUR-TUX.
You can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. We are Going Linux, all one word. You can download the episodes from the website, or you can use the HTML5 or the Flash Player to play them right on the show notes page in your browser.
You can also get future episodes delivered directly to your computer automatically as soon as those new episodes are available. For instructions on how to subscribe to a podcast in order to make all that automatic subscription stuff work, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com. It's really easy. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
New music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.